Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 3. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro. He's an author, educator, and world-renowned Israel tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we'll be examining the vital importance of Jewish unity. Throughout history, the Jewish people have faced countless obstacles and challenges, yet have always managed to survive and thrive due to their unity and sense of collective purpose when we can muster it. We'll examine the clashes and collaborations between ancient traditions and modern innovations and explore how these interactions can shape a better future for everyone. We're jumping into the unique challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish community in the modern era, and how our unity can help us confront these challenges and build a brighter future for all. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. All right. Welcome back, everyone. This is going to be part two of, we're not sure how many parts this is going to end up being, but hi, Rabbi Ken Spiro. We're diving back into the topic we did on our last episode, which is trying to understand the history of Jewish practice and observance. And I think last episode we got up to just before the Shoah. So we looked at the temple, you know, we looked pre-temple, we looked during the temple times and post-temple into the diaspora. And now we're coming up to the pre-Shoah world. So what we're going to look at today is, I think, is the pre-Shoah world, during the Shoah, what was happening, and then post-Shoah, how was Jewish practice and Jewish life rebuilt, both in the European world, the Sephardic world, and the diaspora, and then also in Israel. Let's see where we get to and whether or not we need to do another episode on this. So let's start with pre-Shoah. What is the Jewish world looking like just pre-Holocaust in terms of Ashkenazi and Sephardic practice and life? What are we looking at here?
Right. So we need to remember that, of course, the big change over way prior to the Shoah was the massive, basically, migration of the Jewish world and diaspora of from Ashkenazi to Sephardi, with the expulsion of Jews from Spain, you know, in the end of that community. There'll still be significant Jewish communities in the Middle East and North Africa, but also the movement within Europe itself of Jews from Western Europe to Eastern Europe over the last 500 years, where that will be, that's going to be the center of the Jewish world, with, you know, the late 19th century, like 5.5 million Jews living in the Tsarist Russian Empire, which includes a lot of countries besides Russia, like the Ukraine and White Russia and parts of Poland. And many of those Jews, of course, will have left due to Tsarist Russian persecution, late 19th century, and 2.5 million migrate to America. So you have really the Jewish world is primarily the largest part of the Jewish world, and by far the largest part of the observant Jewish world is going to be in Eastern Europe, in what is the area of Ukraine and White Russia and Lithuania and Poland, especially Northern Poland, the Yeshiva world there. But there'll be a significant Jewish presence, many millions of Jews in America, but people don't also appreciate that the Orthodox Jewish world is in America, which is the biggest community outside of Israel today, is overwhelmingly a byproduct of post-Holocaust. So that even isn't even happened yet. There are plenty of Jews and living in America, but most of them are experiencing the loss of their Judaism through the loss of Shabbat observance, having to work in sweatshops and giving up Shabbat. And, like, you know, he's the famous quote, more than the Jews kept the Sabbath kept the Jews. So, but there's also, Ellie, an interesting kind of almost a romanticization of Eastern European Jewish life as being often poor but religious,
meaning pre-Holocaust, like when everyone looks back and says, oh, the old days before the Holocaust, everyone was religious, we didn't have a lot of material goods, but everyone was, you know, connected and together and religious and doing all the mitzvahs.
Right. So again, if we look at that world of Europe, the Ashkenazi European world, we'll just ignore America for now. You know, Western Europe is far more into assimilation. The reform movement begins there in the early 19th century. The attractiveness of Western European culture is, the pull is very, very strong. So while there will remain Orthodox communities in many of these places, there's a massive amount of assimilation. If you look at like Hungarian Jews and Austrian Jews and German Jews, they're much more into the culture of the nation, the host nation. Hmm. Hungarian Jews especially are obsessed with being Hungarians, and their Judaism is only sort of a tangential side of their identity. Not to say that there weren't strong religious communities in these places, especially in Hungary, Hasidic Jewish world, very strong, but overwhelmingly more assimilationist, more focused on you know, being into that culture and being nominally Jewish on the side. Whereas Eastern Europe, we have that image. That's where we think of, you know, when you think of European Jewry, you're thinking of, you know, the Soviet Union, that part of the world where Jews are basically, religious, but mostly poor. We have to appreciate those Jews who are trapped within the Soviet Union, right, which is a massive number of Jews. There's over 3.3 million Jews when the World War II finally starts, who are living in a world where they've been exposed to massive anti-religious ideology of communism. You get a unique experience there, where it's the only time I know of where you have Jews who are A, being exposed to very significant anti-Semitism, but also assimilating en masse because they've been completely robbed of their Jewish identity with the Russian Revolution 1917. And when Stalin gets to power after Lenin, you know, there's a lot of anti-Semitism in Russia. Mm. But the part of the Jewish world we're really talking about is that's not within communist Russia. It's in Poland and places like that. That is the yeshiva world. And there definitely are plenty of religious Jews, but the majority of them, unlike today, are poorly educated, both in secular and in Jewish studies, meaning they're not studying in yeshivas, only a teeny fraction of that world. Most of them are not going to universities, or there definitely are some who are. Mm-hmm. But most of them are just traditional Jews. We would say, you know, Orthodox by the standard of today, keeping kashrut and Shabbat, but not necessarily that well educated Jewishly, traditional, a kind of Jew that really doesn't exist anymore in the Ashkenazi world. The experience they go through at this period of time is interesting because that part of the world is also, Jews are being drawn into a lot of other things. If you look at Warsaw pre-Holocaust, Poland, the center of the Jewish world, mm-hmm. you know, that if any one country had a lot of Jews in it, it's Poland, like 3 million Jews living there alone. If you go to places like Krakow and Warsaw, which are one third Jewish, that's unbelievable thought. These places are one third Jewish. Out of those, one third of the city is Jewish. A good percentage of those Jews are not. We can tell by the elections for the different, you know, what the Jews are into voting in the Jewish organizations. You have a tremendous number of Jews who are the Bundist socialist kind. Mm-hmm. You have the Jewish intellectuals, the Maskilim, mm-hmm. and you have the Orthodox. So it's kind of like a split, almost one third of these of Jews being into different things. So right. Even a place that's very strongly Jewish, very culturally Jewish, everyone's speaking Yiddish, and these people, even the ones who aren't observant, are only a generation away from observance. So they're also a kind of Jew you don't find today. Jews who are very knowledgeable, maybe in their Judaism, but completely non-observant. Today, you have Jews who are just not ignorant and non-observant. Mm-hmm. So it's a very fraction. It's the basic point I really want to make is that world is really that world was falling apart. It was being attacked from all sides by, you know, secular Zionism and Jewish Enlightenment thinking and pressure from the outside and the pull of you know, just being part of a larger non-Jewish culture and even splits within the Jewish world itself, the Orthodox world. So it wasn't like this kind of everyone's religious, everyone's poor, and they're all kind of together. There's a lot of that. This all gets short-circuited by the Holocaust. It just gets destroyed completely. But, you know, it's counterfactual historical speculation. But had the Holocaust not come along, the Jewish world of Eastern Europe, in my opinion, was largely a house whose foundations were either being infested with termites or cracking. You know, the concrete developed a lot of fault lines in it.
Right.
So there would have been a lot of upheaval that it was internally caused by external pressure and internal pressure that would have probably done a lot of caused many, many significant changes in that world if it hadn't been cut short by the Holocaust.
So in terms of, okay, so just to get a sort of a 30,000 foot view, so you're saying there's about 3 something million Jews in Russia at this time. There's about 3 million Jews or so in like Poland and Eastern Europe, but mostly in Poland. And then where is the Sephardic Sephardic world at this time?
Right. So that's over a third of the Jews of the world living just those two places. What is the Soviet Union and Poland? Then there's so that's a big chunk. The Sephardic Jewish world, which at this point is only maybe 10% of the Jewish world, amazing switch from being 90% 1,000 years earlier, is spread again through North Africa and the Middle East, with, you know, places out to Iraq and Afghanistan. And that world, of course, is living amongst in the Muslim world. That world has sort of gone in retrograde from, because the Arab world, the larger Muslim Islamic world, has sort of gone backwards in its development to a much more third world experience. But it also experienced a lot of colonialism from the outside, like North Africa is colonized by, you know, the French and the Italians and, you know, and the Middle East also by the British. And so there's an interest, there's a lot of factors going on in that world too. So, but the difference being is because the Enlightenment doesn't come to the Arab world, and arguably it's yet to come, there's not the external draw of that higher culture that's pulling Jews in places like Germany, Austria, Hungary into it. That's not very attractive. It's like living in a kind of a third world country. You're not going to be drawn to the outside. So generally the Jews stay, they interact with their non-Jewish neighbors, but there's much more cohesiveness and there's much less external temptation. But because there's much more like first world development, there's much less interest or demand or desire to go into higher education and things that are, there's not a lot of doctors and lawyers and things like that you have in developed first world countries. Mm-hmm. So the Sephardic Jewish world is overwhelmingly traditional, also mostly not well educated, either secular or in terms of yeshiva learning. There's a very small percentages of people learning in yeshivas in any of these places. Probably less fractionalized in the Ashkenazi world. Mm-hmm. Even today, it still remains less so, although each of these places has their very different traditions and customs and halachic observance from different communities. North Africa is very different from the Middle East. We tend to lump them all together as Sephardim, but it's actually a misnomer. But that community is also not experiencing the same level of, like, the anti-Semitism of the Arab world is not as intense. It's starting to take off, by the way, because of the infestation of European anti-Semitism into the Arab mind and the rise of Zionism and the collision course that's going to take with, you know, the Arabs living in the land of Israel, which is going to spread a lot to the Arab world. But there really isn't the same issues going on. That's not a world that is like, has the same levels of assimilation, it's not, or intermarriage, it's not a world that has the same level of feeling of external threats. These are Jews that have been living in many of these places for literally thousands of years. As long as Jews lived in Poland, Jews lived in Iraq for a heck of a lot longer. But it's a much smaller percentage of the Jewish world. And it's going to be less affected, obviously, by the Holocaust, because the Germans, with the exception of North Africa, don't get too far into that part of the world. Had they, it would have been a very different story. So it really is. And by the way, you see the development in the Ashkenazi world of a really kind of, I'm generalizing, condescending attitude towards Sephardim as being just basically people, third world Jews, of color, Jews of color living in the third world who are, no one, don't have the education or the cultural sophistication that we have. It's sort of almost a colonialist attitude that the white Europeans have towards the dark skinned people of Africa and the Middle East, the same too. You get to the white skinned European Jews are going to sort of develop that attitude to a certain extent towards their brethren.
Interestingly enough, all of those white skinned European Jews used to be dark skinned Mena Jews also, because they came from that region. Eventually, it was just through, you know, decades and centuries of being in Eastern Europe, they, you know, slowly assimilated, not just in terms of culture, but in terms of melanin. So it's interesting that there's this weird idea that they're different when really they're just really the same family. So it's fascinating. At this point, also, how many Jews are in North America? What does that look like at that time?
So the North American Jewish community is several million Jews by this point. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. It's grown significantly since then. It's more than doubled in size since pre-Holocaust. But it's actually, as a part of the Jewish world, it's a higher percentage of American population than it is today. Right after the Holocaust, the Jews in America are like 2.3% of the United States population. I believe today it's less than 2%. So they're fewer Jews, but the American population is much smaller. And of course, they're highly concentrated in the same places they are today. But again, largely lacking in the Torah infrastructure that enables them to maintain their Jewish identity. But then again, at this period of time, there's a lot of low-level anti-Semitism in America, and Jews are just one or two generations, really maximum two generations on mass in America. So there's a much deeper connection to their Jewish identity and much less acceptance on the outside world and much less temptation. The intermarriage rates in America at this time are very small, you know, probably around 3-4% pre-Holocaust, and compared to where they are today at over outside, excluding Ashkenazi, you know, the Orthodox world, they're over 70%. So it's a very different reality. So again, it's kind of like Europe, only a little bit different. There's not that many centuries of distinctly Jewish culture that's evolved. It's not necessarily religious, but there's they're definitely a very strong sub-community, tending to be highly concentrated. You don't have the explosion of the suburban Jewish experience, where Jews, you know, move away from their communities and away from their synagogues and start spreading out to different places. So there's much more cohesiveness within the community.
Wild. So then if we come back then to pre-Holocaust, right before the Shoah, so what we're looking at is a picture of a Jewish community, you know, that a Jewish community that is closest to where the Holocaust is going to take place, that is fractured, that is a third of it is religious, another third of it is, as you said, like a communist socialist, and another third is part of the Enlightenment, part of the university world, part of the assimilation into Eastern European culture. So how then does, what does Jewish practice look like if you're not in the Orthodox world at that point? Are you connected to a Jewish community? Is everybody just running away from the Jewish community? Are people, is there some kind of middle ground, like here in the United States where, sorry, I mean Canada, but in the United States, North America, you know, they created these sort of false dichotomies around like, oh, we're going to have denominations of Judaism, which I guess is, you know, modeled on the idea of religion from, say, Christianity, like, oh, now we have Reform and we have conservative, but, you know, Judaism is something that predates religion. So the idea of denominations is also very strange to us. But do we have anything like that in Eastern Europe where people are like, oh, no, I'm still observant, I'm just conservative, or I'm Reform? Like, what does that look like?
Right. I mean, first of all, just to qualify a little what you said about, you know, the third kind of thing, that's kind of based on the, you know, the communal election tallies we get from big urban centers where there's a large number of Jews living. You obviously, it's very different experience when you're living out in some little villages, you know, and eking out a meager living in some little shtetl somewhere in Eastern Europe. You're not going to have the same, you know, external attractiveness of the larger culture, nor the diversity of opportunities to do things. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a different experience. It's more like the fiddler on the roof thing. In terms of movements, you know, there is a Reform movement exists in Europe. If you go to Prague, you can see this beautiful Reform synagogue. It's like a Byzantine, you know, building with like an organ and everything. So these movements do, which begin in France and spread to Germany, definitely get into Europe, but they're definitely not the majority of Jews are attracted to them. But in major urban centers, they're definitely significant, especially in Western Europe. Obviously, there's much more attractive, and this Reform movement is much more impactful. Conservative is a uniquely American experience. It doesn't exist in Europe at this time at all. So it's basically, you have that opportunity to be Reform, but there's really nothing else besides Orthodoxy outside of that. So, and again, you have a lot of Jews who are just, you see this in England till today, you know, like the United Synagogue in England, where it's the biggest movement. And these Jews are not necessarily Sabbath observant. They're traditional. The synagogue they do or don't go to is going to be Orthodox, even though they don't really identify as such. So you have that you have that situation in the major urban centers. But what's interesting is also you don't have the cohesiveness of different Jewish communities. It's much more broken up. And, you know, you have today, we have a very different experience of us. You have great rabbis who are leaders of communities that we read about, like the Chafetz Chaim, and people, this guy ran, by the way, a grocery store. The Chafetz Chaim, you know, view him as this huge rabbi. We venerate him as a tremendous scholar, but he was actually a very kind of down-to-earth person who lived a very simple life and ran a business on the side. But different communities tended to, what you have pre-Holocaust is much more impact. You have much more local rabbinic authority, because the world's a much bigger place before the internet and mass communication unites us and we spread ideas around, and communities are much more concentrated in fewer geographic locations than they were back then. So if you lived in some little town, many of these little shtetls didn't even have a rabbi. They maybe had a minion because there weren't enough Jews living in them. But if you lived in any place with a sizable Jewish community, you probably had some sort of local rabbinic personality, and he was the authority for your community. In larger cities, you had diversification of communities. One of the interesting, you know, processes we've seen in the Jewish world with the spreading out of Jews outside the land of Israel at the end of the Sanhedrin is that kind of lack of central authority. And it's more and more spread out. But what's also interesting is that what really, I would say, from a historical perspective, governs what the Jewish people have done is much more to do with custom and much less to do with halacha. It's an interesting discussion of itself, because aren't they the same? What does it mean? There's, within anyone who knows about halacha from the inside knows, there's a wide range of expressing your level of observance. And people tend to basically do, we say, mincha gavoteinu biyadeinu, the customs of our fathers, of our forefathers in our hands. Well, that's what people did. And we can see the historical, this is also totally lost on the Jewish world today. The Orthodox world does not get this point, that custom trumped halacha. Any day you wanted to get people to change what they do, it wasn't because you innovate in halacha. It was much more because this is what my parents and my grandparents did, and this is what I'm going to do. This is my local rabbi. This idea of minhag hamakom, the custom of the place, I think is much more prevalent phenomenon in the Jewish world back then, because it was a smaller world. It was much less interaction and opportunity to interact or learn from other geographic areas or rabbis outside of your communities.
I think that's so fascinating, this idea of like the globalization of practice that we're witnessing, which is, you know, when you mentioned like, you know, that we weren't as connected, you couldn't know, you know, three villages over how they were practicing this particular halacha, what their minhag hamakom was, what their tradition of the place was. So each place understood it based on their learning, their rabbi, their traditions, what their parents did, what their grandparents did. And it could look different from one place to another. Whereas now a lot of what we're seeing is a globalization of those customs, those practices, those chumras, those, you know, that halacha is one thing, but it's becoming more and more homogenous what observant Jewish practice looks like, because we're able to share that. And even though there isn't necessarily a huge agreement or unanimous vote on who is the leader of this movement, a lot of what we're seeing is the pressure coming from the community itself that everybody practices the same way. And that I see now the impact that that's had, as opposed to everybody living in their own sort of siloed communities, and the way you practice looks like what your parents and your grandparents and their grandparents looked like, but you could go from one town to another and potentially have very different practices, interpretations, and understandings of what mainstream Jewish practice looks like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's red lines within which everyone fell. And again, most people didn't have access to. Today, you can go online and you get access to an insane amount of information. You can even call up a big rabbi and send them a question. You know, your local authority, your local rabbi, many places, even up until post-war, didn't really even have a rabbi. They had like a reverend. In England, you had like a guy who acted as the cheder teacher and the sheikhet and the moel, and he trained the boys for bar mitzvah. And if you had a question, you know, like the local authority might be able to answer if your chicken's kosher. But when you get to more complicated questions of marriage and divorce, and then that could be really, you knew that there was always, you know, with these sort of the spreading out of the Jewish world, you had you know, rabbis and yeshivas go together. The great mm-hmm. rabbinic minds have often been educators and run yeshivot of various sizes. So like in Eastern Europe, there was definitely appreciation that with the modern yeshiva movement, it begins in Volozhin in the early 19th century and all the offshoots that come out of it, Slobodka and you have Volozhin and you have the Mir and Panovich and these yeshivas that still exist today, albeit not in situ in Europe, but that spread to places like Israel and America as the center of the Orthodox Jewish world. But you'd often pass these questions up. It could take a very long time to get an answer. But your general interaction with these people was extremely limited, which also is an interesting phenomenon, which is completely lost, I believe, on the Orthodox Jewish world today. The impact of yeshivot on the larger world was significantly less, regardless of how great the rabbi in the yeshiva was. Like in, even if you go to like the Vilna Gaon, we're talking about, you know, the early 19th century, late 18th century, the Elijah Mevilna, you know, the great, one of the greatest Jewish minds. His influence did not extend outside of his Talmidim, which he had quite a few of. I mean, his
when students, you say quite a few, like what does that mean?
He had hundreds of students, hundreds and hundreds of people, Talmid Agra, but the Jewish community in which the larger Jewish community in which he lived in Lithuania was significantly larger than just his community, and other people in the community would follow their rabbis. So the notion that there was just a couple of rabbis calling the shots, like you have today. A few rabbis, literally a handful. Well, I would say maybe, you know, it depends. You have to subdivide between the American yeshiva world and the Haredi world of Israel. But you really is a couple in America and a couple in Israel that really get to call the shots on everything. And that's something that sort of recentralization of authority in a few people. Mm-hmm. But it's, again, diversified between different communities that might not follow anything of each other. I'm not just talking about Ashkenazim. In the Sephardic world, you have this thing today with Obadi Yosef, Alav Shalom, and his descendants, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, and that. There's a sort of almost dynasties of rabbinic leadership that have their own students and their students' students. You don't have that in the vast majority of places in Europe. You really don't have, you know, like a place like Warsaw. You don't think of Warsaw as a great yeshiva community. Lublin had, you know, Chachmei Lublin, you know, you had, but a lot of, sometimes the largest Jewish communities didn't necessarily have the largest yeshiva communities. So even within those communities, you had tremendous diversification of different subgroups of Jews following their own little rabbi doing this or that. So it's really changed tremendously. But really, the vast majority of Jews who are not necessarily living in major urban centers are just doing what their parents did. And they don't really necessarily know how, why. If you had to explain it halakhically, they would not know. And that's how the Jewish world was really working. Well, overwhelmingly for those Jews who remained traditional.
So once we get, so that's a really fascinating picture of what the Jewish world looked like before the Holocaust. So at this point, once the, you know, World War II begins, Jews are being rounded up. Eastern European Jews are at, you know, as we all know, in peril. That entire world is being burned to the ground, literally and figuratively. So at this point, what is happening in these different worlds? Where is the Sephardic world? What are they know and doing about this, or how are they managing? What is the Eastern European world doing? And what's happening to learning, and what's going on in North America? So just give us a picture of what that looks like.
Right. We're talking about, again, like pre-start of World War II, with World War II starting. Or the Hitler
I think from as World War II is beginning, and, you know, and the reason we want to look at this particular shorter period of time is so that once we get to post-World War II and looking at how we rebuild the Jewish world, Jewish practice, and things like that. So in that transitional, it's not transitional, but, you know, for lack of a better term, while World War II is going on, where is everybody and what's happening with Jewish practice at that point?
Yeah. So, I mean, we start with the East, you know, those Jews living in the Soviet Union have already been horrendously traumatized. The Russian Revolution, which is taking place, you know, less than two decades before Hitler comes to power, was a traumatic experience spiritually and physically for the Jewish people. The civil war that envelops Russia and what happens afterwards And in Ukraine is devastating spiritually and physically. Spiritually, because of the anti-religious nature of communism, which really goes after Jewish infrastructure, which had already been very badly damaged by Tsarist Russia. And physically, hundreds of thousands of Jews are killed and displaced physically by the trauma that sweeps through. And it's a very traumatic experience for the population at large, the Russian Revolution. So that's a part of the world which is spiritually basically unhinged. So they don't have, they're now living under Stalinist terror and purges. Affects Jews as always disproportionately, but Stalin's killing everyone. He killed more of his own people probably than Hitler killed in World War II that died fighting the German army. Wow. So that's a world that's really in peril on every level, physically and spiritually. When Hitler gets to power in 1933, Europe had no idea it was coming. The general Jewish, we'll see the attitude of the Jewish world is, we've outlasted everything till now. And no one understood how unique Hitler was and his level of animus and his creation of mechanized mass murder of an entire people, which had never, the Jewish people had experienced pretty traumatic things, but nothing like this before on that scale. Places like Germany.
Think there was a little bit of a boiled frog syndrome going on there? Like anti-Semitism had just always been so bad in Europe and in Russia. And in a way, like you're kind of being boiled to death without being knowing it, meaning it was just getting progressively worse. But everyone's like, so what? It's always bad. Like everybody always like is hating on the Jews and using us as a scapegoat for their own problems. And it's been going on for centuries. And so how is this any different? Do you think that was a little bit of what was going on there?
Yeah, for sure. And it's also partly psychological denial.
Yeah.
And I also think that many Europeans truly felt, people always ask, where is God during the Holocaust? And, the first answer is always, where was man?
Right.
The Holocaust is a great illustration of the failure of enlightened Western European civilization because it comes out of Germany and Austria. And these are the most technologically, culturally, in many ways, even governmentally advanced places in the world.
Yeah.
I think that many Jews actually believed at this time that the enlightened European civilization would basically phase out anti-Semitism.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I just read an article about this that was saying that the consciousness of the world was so rocked because when they looked at Austria and Germany, it was the most technologically advanced, philosophically enlightened, organized, civilized places on the face of the earth at that time. And then when you could see the monstrosity of what people living in a highly technologically advanced, civilized, educated world could do to other humans, it rocked the consciousness of humanity because you realize that technology, education, and civilization doesn't necessarily make people better.
Right. Exactly. 100%. And in a place like Germany, it's most shocking because they're the ones who get to experience it first in 1933. And clearly they thought it would not last. There's a great book by Amos Elon, who's a very left-wing Israeli. He's no longer with us. He's a left-wing Israeli historian, but it's one of the better history books I've ever read about Jews in Germany from 1743 to 1933. Mm. And these are people who love Germany more than anything. They were more German than anyone. And in the end, the book ends with people in Berlin basically like committing suicide because everything they had spent over a century earning through their, integrating, assimilating to German society and benefiting from the Enlightenment, the post-Napoleonic Wars, the emancipation is just gone, literally, by the time you get to 1935. So I think there, even after the Nuremberg Laws hit in 35, remember Hitler gets to power in 33 and suspends democracy and makes it a one-party totalitarian state and starts focusing on the Jews immediately. But I think people really didn't know what was coming.
Right.
So that's what's going on there. And obviously around in the rest of Europe, Hitler's a phenomenon, but I don't think, no one saw what was going to happen with his very initially successful conquest within a year and a half of all of Europe. I mean, it's an amazing military campaign that the Nazis been starting in 1939. What's going on, by the way, in Europe in general, even in America and this is a point that people don't get, is that progressive political ideologies, and I know the word progressive is very loaded today because the left uses the word, but Nazism, it's interesting that the the left always calls the right Nazis, but Nazism is an acronym for National Socialism. It's a toxic kind of convergence of nationalism with progressive socialist ideology. It's just different from communism, and communism is a universal ideology. It dropped the notion of nationalism, but they're both very top-down government. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Germany, in alliance with business, you know, big government top-down, big business control of everything. These ideologies, fascism, and really the founder of all these movements is Benito Mussolini, who has a big head start on Hitler. These are all progressive political ideologies, which are extremely popular, not in Europe,
right,
all throughout Europe, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, mm-hmm. In England, America, the Bund. You have Nazi rallies. Hitler gets to power. There's, you know, people like Lindbergh, who is running for president. You know, there's a book written about, there's a counterfactual speculation book that he becomes president. You know, there's a lot of popularity of these movements. There's a lot of sentiment that is pro-fascist and pro-Nazi.
Right.
You know, King Edward abdicated when he married. He visited Hitler, you know, Edward and Wallace Simpson. They love this guy, you know. There was a lot of, in England, there's a lot of, let's make a deal with Chairman Hitler.
So, well, the royalty comes from Germans. So there's no surprise there. There was a great love and connection.
That's why they changed their name from Saxe-Coburg to Windsor in World War I, because it didn't look good to have the royal family of England with a German last name. But there's a certain level of, I think, unease in a lot of the world. The Jews are very uneasy, and you have, you know, the Bund Nazi rallies in the United States. You have people like Henry Ford serializing the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, Father Joseph Coughlin with his rapidly anti-Semitic radio show, where 30 million Americans are listening to him, you know, rant and rave with similar ideology to what Hitler's saying about Jews being the plague on humanity.
Right.
So there's that certain level of uneasiness and tension, but again, no one really sees what is coming. And like I said, a lot of people are literally living in denial. Mm-hmm. In America, you know, it's low-level anti-Semitism, but compared to what the Jews, these people in America's grandparents had gone through in Poland, it's, or Russia, it's nothing.
Right.
And in Europe, everyone is, you know, creeps up on you. We see it, we view history in reverse, so we mm-hmm. see what happens at the end. They don't see this happening. Obviously, in North Africa, in the Middle East, you know, there's the rise of Arab nationalism. There's certainly a certain level of increase in anti-Semitism linked to Zionism and Jewish nationalism versus Arab nationalism and the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. But it's nothing like what's going on in Europe.
Right.
There's nothing like these people. It's a very different experience.
Got it. So Mena Jews and Sephardic Jews at that time are just dealing with their own problems, like trying to survive in the Arab world in North Africa and in their own, you know, sort of bubble there. So, okay. So that gives us a picture of like what's going on with these communities and where is everybody. So once the proverbial hammer comes down, meaning that, you know, there really is this horrific genocide of the Jewish people, you know, and I realize we're skipping over, you know, really the trauma itself. Where do we end up? Where do we, like, once we sort of get a look at how many Jews have been destroyed? Now, is this a real statistic that 2/3 of the yeshiva world was destroyed? Is that accurate? Or is there another way?
Something like that. Yeah, something like that. It's interesting also because, you know, a place like Germany, Jews had actually, the German Jewish population, a good chunk of it, more than half, was able to leave because they had from 33 to 39 to get out, even though there weren't too many options to go anywhere. And even though the quotas to go to America of 200,000 Jews were never fulfilled because it was so difficult to actually bring someone into the country during the Great Depression.
Meaning many, many countries, because of the white paper, because of all of these legislative and political acts, countries shut Jews out and wouldn't let them escape.
The British started,
so they were stuck in Germany.
Exactly. But not only that, you have to appreciate, there's another thing that's lost and often not talked about is, you know, there was people that, you know, the storm, the dark clouds are gathering on the horizon, and Hitler, and even when and Jews had opportunities to leave. And you know, well, where could you go to? The greatest opportunity was to go to places that didn't have a lot of Jewish infrastructure, which means you'd be physically maybe safer, but spiritually in much greater danger. Like I said, you know, 100 years ago, or more than 100 years ago, the two places that rabbis and yeshivas would warn you not to go were Israel and America. Very ironic.
Wow.
Israel was basically 100, you know, like talking about decades before World War II, Israel was basically being now stocked and staffed by secular Zionists who were largely anti-religious. And America was nothing, was spiritual wasteland, the Golden Medina. So, and you have to overlay on that the Jewish worldview, the Hashkafic worldview, that the body is a temporal thing. It gets here today, gone tomorrow, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Your soul is your eternity. And the idea, it's a very big theme in Judaism, the idea of, you know, better to die with your soul intact. You know, Al Kiddush Hashem, giving up your life for what you believe, then, you know, to give up your soul, so to speak, give up your Judaism, but survive physically, because that's your eternity. I know it's a heavy thing to discuss in general, but there's a lot of, I've come across a lot of interactions, letters, and interesting historical documentation of people asking, we can get out, we can go. I'm not talking about when the Nazis have invaded Poland already, then they would have said, run like hell. Right. But before that, the lead up to that, and rabbis advising, you know, their and Hasidic rebbes, who themselves often had to be smuggled out and they survived while all their Hasidim were slaughtered. In the end, saying, no, stay here, because if, you know, it's similar to the letter that the third Lubavitcher Rebbe writes during Napoleonic Wars, you know, like, should the Tsar win? You know, Napoleon's the big advocate of emancipation and freedom for Jews, but, you know, should the Tsar stay in power and the Russians win, that we might suffer physically, but we will survive spiritually. But if Napoleon wins, we'll be sucked into the tidal wave of assimilation. So that ideology, because that world is so already traumatized,
right?
Not just by physical levels of destruction that have, and expulsions that have hit the Ashkenazic Jewish world that have pushed them into Poland, and then they get slapped there with the, you know, in the 17th century, the Michalonitsky massacres. But now the onslaught is viewed more as a spiritual threat. The assimilationists, the Bundists, the secular Zionists, all these people, they're going to steal your soul. You're going to go to America, the Golden Medina. No, stay here.
And I would also love to understand as well, like, how much of that was also the Christian influence of being in Eastern Europe, where the Jewish life becomes about the afterlife more than it becomes about the present life. You know, and I know that we have, of course, this idea of our spiritual life being, you know, we're a soul in a body. We're not a, like a body, we're a soul first. But I am curious, and maybe this is for another conversation, because that attitude of saying, you know, better to preserve your soul and sacrifice the body. I'm very curious how much of that textually we would look at to really have agreement that that's really what we're about. It'd be curious for me.
That's interesting. I personally don't think that's the case. I mean, you have to distinguish between the Christian medieval idea of, like, this life sucks, but just submit to authority and preserve the feudal system, which the church was the biggest player in. And you'll get your payoff in, you know, heaven,
right?
Which is sort of like, this is that's your get out of jail ticket. Whereas the Jewish idea is, no, the soul is your eternity. I think it's a much more profound understanding of how the world works, and how this world is like the corridor and the real banquet. It's the hors d'oeuvres is this world, and the banquet is, you know, and the real experience, the real level of pleasure. So there's a similarity in the concepts, I understand, but I don't think that the Orthodox Jewish world of Europe is really affected by those Christian teachings. But I do feel that there really is a sort of collective paranoia and trauma of fear of, you know, you're just going to lose your Judaism. It's going to be, it's going to be gone. And you don't want to lose that. That's what it's all about. That's what Judaism's all about, is your soul's connection to God. And then that's the purpose of creation, and feeling that that's going to be threatened. You're going to be sucked in by culture and materialism. So I think that plays a much bigger role. So even as the clouds are gathering on the horizon, you're seeing a lot of inertia on the part of Jews saying, no, we'll just batten down the hatches, and this will wash over us like everything else that's washed over us. And we'll survive it, and we'll survive spiritually intact. We might take a beating, but we'll keep on, you know, we'll keep going. And that really is what's setting the stage for what's about to hit Europe. And again, those people who are living, those Jews who are living much more in the major urban centers, like in Budapest and in places like Vienna, who are only, you know, tangentially like this, their Jewish identity is very much on the side. They're going to be in for a real shock, because they really do believe. You know, I don't think the Jews living in Eastern Europe had quite the same romantic idea about the Eastern Europeans, who were generally more, especially outside the urban centers, who were, you know, poor, often very deeply anti-Semitic. It's kind of like in in the collective consciousness of a lot of Eastern Europeans, very religious. And right. to the extent that we're amongst extremely, almost fanatically religious, superstitiously poorly educated people, they generally look at us very badly. Whereas if you live in a nice, enlightened Western European city, which is all about brotherhood and humanism and enlightenment, it's far more shocking to believe, you know, that things like that can happen in Vienna right. after the Anschluss, you know, the day after the Nazis just pull into Austria with no one stops them. The next day, these very upper crusty Viennese Jews are out in the streets cleaning them with their toothbrushes and brushes, you know, as their neighbors are looking at them and taunting them, you know, like right. just like boom, overnight, it's like complete everything out the wow. window. You lost it all.
Wow.
That's pretty traumatic.
100%, both psychologically and emotionally, in terms of like what is reality, like it would make you question everything you ever believed. And of course, physically, you know, and losing your family, losing your friends, losing your home, losing your jobs, losing everything, as you said, practically overnight. You know, the level of trauma in that is unspeakable. So where do we end up then? You know, okay, so let's just check in time-wise. Do you think we should, like, now that we've gotten to the, you know, the end of the Holocaust, now we wanted to talk about where do we rebuild Jewish practice from there? Should we dip into that and then continue next episode? Or do you think we can dig into that enough today?
I think it requires a lot more than we're going to have time to do today, yeah. but we can start to like talk about like immediate post Holocaust, where's the Jewish world holding, kind of right. setting the stage for, I think, the next discussion about what is basically the last 75, 80 years of where we are today, great. Which is really a byproduct of so much of that experience.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know, there's been big traumas like the expulsion of Jews from Spain. Overnight, a community ceases to exist.
Yeah.
This is one of those traumas on steroids where a third of the Jews of the world are killed within a period of 6 years.
Yeah.
And the entire infrastructure, culturally, economically, and certainly spiritually, is completely decimated of the Ashkenazic Jewish world of Eastern Europe. It doesn't happen to the Sephardi world again. I mean, if you know what happens to World War II, the Nazis get to North Africa and Vichy set up in Morocco a government. And, you know, there's a few Jews killed in North Africa. But, you know, because the El Alamein, the British stopped the German army, mm-hmm. you know, had they made it through North Africa, Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti, who was appointed by the British in the 1920s, who became a psychophantic lover of Nazism and raised right. an SS unit in the Balkans to kill Jews, you know, in that part of Europe, he asked Hitler to set up death camps, but they didn't, the Sephardic world did not go through that trauma. It's amazing how lacking it is in their psyche, because it just was right. not an experience for them to right. go through. I mean, if you live in Israel, and a much higher percentage of Israel is a Sephardic Middle Eastern than in the Jewish world at large. Mm. And now they've been more exposed to it because it's such a part of the collective historical experience, and the raison d'etre of the Jewish state is to prevent the Holocaust from happening, but it doesn't right. affect them as much. The Jews in America who managed to be those communities that survived outside of Hitler's sphere of influence, you know, are, it's very interesting what goes on and what doesn't go on, how many of them do little or nothing.
Right.
And are also kind of in denial. Some do, by the way, but this is a remarkable lack of connection and lack of proactivity on the part of even a lot of American Jews for what's going on with their brethren, as much as they know about it. And you can ask, what could they do? But even in the upper echelons of America, people like Stephen Weiss, who was the head of the American Jewish Congress and a close confidant of Roosevelt, was remarkably complacent about, or actively, we're not going to place Jewish interests above the greater interests of America and ending the war. And that's a whole other interesting discussion. But when we look at what happened to what is the heart and soul of the Jewish world, which is Europe, it's completely traumatized. Those communities, right. some of which will be able to recover a little bit more in Western Europe. Eastern Europe does not recover from this, really doesn't. I mean, you know, Eastern Europe of what was the Soviet Union, which was largely overrun by the Nazis. You know, a lot of the killing that takes place in the war is the Germans getting a hold of places like the Ukraine. Although had they been more successful and had the Soviet Union fallen, there would have been another 3 million more dead Jews. So we would have had 10 million dead Jews post-Holocaust. So, you know, that part of the world never recovers because it's under communism. So it wasn't right. like it was destroyed, but plenty of Jews fight in the Soviet army and plenty of Jews die fighting the Nazis and plenty of Jews are killed in places like the Ukraine and White Russia. But the part of the Jewish world that is really completely leveled and the part of the Jewish world that was the center of Torah learning is really, you know, Northern Poland, Lithuania, that part of the Jewish world. And there, it's the complete gutting of that world, which is the center. It's like the soul is ripped out of the Jewish people in terms of leadership. So some of those rabbis will make it out, some before, some will be smuggled out during, and a few will survive and make it to America after. But and America and Israel will then, that's the big shifting. It's the massive migration, ironically, in the end, precisely those places which, you
fascinating.
Know, the Holocaust 50 years earlier would have been the two places they would never have thought of going by default and because of lack of choice of anywhere else. That is the place where the Jews will, that's the religious world is going to rebuild itself in those two communities.
Fascinating. Okay, so next episode, then we're going to dig into taking a look at the building of those North American and Israel and the communities in Israel. What is happening on the ground in Eastern Europe at that point? Where does everybody go? You know, who's there, and what starts to happen in terms of rebuilding Jewish communities? I do have one question, which I think also goes to what we're talking about today, which is during the Holocaust itself, what was happening to say things like Jewish practice, like prayer or Shabbat? Were there many people who just simply abandoned it altogether to try to save themselves? Were there people? It seems to me there's many who go through the Holocaust and connect themselves to Hashem and never let go, and many who go through the Holocaust who really just break that relationship altogether. It's either, you know, total cutoff or total fusion and very little in between. So what does that look like? Can you give us an idea of any of the, what that looks like?
Yeah. Interesting. By the way, I have a collection. I have a set of books called Letters from Jews Throughout the Ages. And it's just various correspondents that have survived going back, you know, centuries, even millennia. Wow. And some of them talk about some pretty horrendous slaughters of Jewish communities, primarily in Europe. What's interesting, Ellie, is I never found in any of these letters anyone asking where is God until you get to the 20th century. And it's interesting. And some of them are quite unbelievable in that they're openly saying it's because of how we're behaving this is happening to us. You know, because we're not keeping our side of the bargain, our relationship with God. This is a very fundamental part of Jewish worldview, that external threats to the Jewish people, whether they be through floods and famine or through conquering armies and anti-Semites, are always a byproduct of our failure and our contractual relationship with the big guy upstairs. And I think people, Jews lived with, I think, I'm not to say there were people who doubted and had crises of faith throughout history. I'm just saying I didn't see it in these letters. And I think that the strength, Jewish people's strength in Emunah was just stronger. I think precisely, ironically, when you get to the Holocaust, when people's, it's precisely the people whose, I think, faith going in, I'm not saying, of course, I didn't live through it and I can't say for sure. And I'm sure people came, there's people who went in as very observant and left very unobservant. I'm sure the emotional trauma of that experience.
100%. Yeah. We can't judge somebody's response to their own trauma. These are individual responses and of them are heartbreaking in their own choices in terms of the pain that people are in. So we're not here judging people's choices post
100%, not at all.
What we're trying to understand is why were those choices the choices?
Right. 100%. But I have a suspicion that because of the weakening in many people's faith in general, because of external, not physical threats, but spiritual challenges, brings this issue to the forefront. And of course, magnify that with the absolute incomprehensible level of the Holocaust, a level of just in sheer numbers and level of brutality and mechanized mass murder that is just so emotionally traumatic for such a, by the way, an incredibly long period of time. People forget that too. You know, the Crusades sweep through communities and pogroms last for a few days. It might come back a few years later, but to go through 6 years of that. So it's a combination of factors, but that definitely is going to play a big role in I think shaking people up. But in terms of observance, that's a really interesting First of all, one of the most interesting books I've ever read is called The Holocaust and Halacha, which deals with questions, because we know that halacha deals with, there's nothing outside the purview of halacha, mm-hmm. from the most mundane things about the laws of going to the bathroom to the most sublime things about spiritual connection and sacrificing your life. And it's amazing the questions that people would ask rabbis, blowaway questions. You know, my son was selected to be deported to his death. I can pay off a guard to take someone else. This is a really heavy question. Which is, whose blood is redder, that kind of stuff. Wow. Or you go to Yad Vashem, you could see it on display there, people who would trade in their bread rations. And you're starving to death for the chance some guy's making a business out of, he somehow has like a prayer book or a pair of tefillin, he somehow managed to smuggle in. And you could trade in your daily food. This is when you're living on starvation level rations, eating sawdust ridden bread and maggoty soup. You'll be trading what little nutrition you have to be able to put tefillin on. And people doing a Passover Seder in a barracks because they got to hold a little bit of grain and they made mini matzahs. And so many people strengthened their desire to be connected. And it really depends. I think it's one of those PhD theses I'm not qualified to write, but I think it largely depends on how you went in with your worldview. Is how you came out was largely affected by what you went in with, your level of connection and how you had an idea of the bigger picture. I mean, it's easy to say, not having lived through it. I can't imagine how it would affect people emotionally.
And worldview is built by so many things. It's built by our, by the loving connections in our families. It's built by our experience of people, of those around us who are able to emotionally and psychologically handle difficulty. Like, our worldview is built by so many things. So coming from communities that have just been intergenerational trauma going back, thousands of years, we can understand that people were already going into that with complicated worldviews.
Exactly. But also understanding that for 6 years, people who had been like, especially have these Hasidic Jews, their entire world, the Orthodox community revolves around, observance, how you dress, what you look like. Then you're in a camp. No kippah, no kosher food, no minyan, no nothing. You're completely stripped of your spiritual infrastructure on every possible level.
Right.
And to try and maintain anything and go without that for so long. And obviously a lot of kids were, smuggled out of the ghettos and raised by non-Jews and raised as Catholics. And that's another story altogether.
Right.
But for Jews who are mature and new and came from observance and to that on every level, the entire physical infrastructure of European, Eastern European Jewry is decimated. Most, synagogues are destroyed. Torah scrolls are burned. Rabbis are executed, mikvahs are gone. Russia was already gone. And now the rest of Europe has it. So nowadays, ironically, some of it's been rebuilt. You now have like Jewish culture in places where Chachmei Lublin has been rebuilt and the synagogues are being rebuilt, but there's no Jews left to occupy them. They're like cultural pilgrimage sites for Jews, but it's complete gutting on every level.
Wow.
Of Jewish identity, and again, never recovered from that. But how people maintain any level of connectivity is a fascinating story is much written about. And there's a great, I have a collection of letters. I bought a book at Yad Vashem, just letters from the Holocaust, people writing, just to go through. That's the best stuff to read, is primary source material.
Right.
And how they talk about what they're going through and how they perceive it. Writing to friends and family is quite fascinating.
Wow.
And it obviously varies tremendously based on the person, where they were and what they went through and what they witnessed.
Wow. Yeah, I'm actually going to give a shout out to one of my closest friends, Jody Spiegel, who works with the Israeli Holocaust Remembrance Program, and they publish survivors' memoirs, and they fact check them, and they put them into formats like audiobooks and books that they give out to libraries. And like you said, those first person accounts were some of the first interactions that I had with understanding the Holocaust and its impact, and it's just so powerful. So for anyone listening, I definitely recommend checking those out as well. Okay, so I think maybe what we'll do is we'll end here and pick up next episode. So much to dig into, and I think, if you're a person who is fascinated, cares about, is part of, or is in some way interested in understanding what Jewish practice looks like today and why, and what our Jewish communities look like today and why, I think this is just such a powerful conversation. So thank you so much, Rabbi Ken Spiro.
Yeah.
And we'll continued.
call the next episode Judaism Today, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Right.
From
exactly.
The best and worst experiences we went through is who we are today.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. The potential for healing.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, everyone. All right. Have a great week. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.